Welcome to Radio EcoShock, your source for environment news and activism on CFRO, Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. This week we're going down to the sea with a special feature called Murder in the Deep. Find out why the United Nations is finally trying to rein in deep-sea trawlers that are clear-cutting the ocean bottom. We have Catherine Stewart in the studio, telling us what fish are safe to buy so you and I can avoid participating in the destruction. We'll also be talking about the latest developments to stop farmed salmon from wrecking wild salmon in BC. Coming back to land, we get an update from the Greenpeace campaign against genetic engineering of your food supply. MLA Shane Simpson will join us to tell us what the provincial government is doing about climate change. Then Amber Dawn will wrap up the show with local sounds from our eco-village. Lots to do, let's get going, with a popular EcoShock production speaking for the creatures of the sea. Murder in the Deep was broadcast on a dozen college and community radio stations. We're honored to find it posted on the Greenpeace International Oceans media page. Go ahead and record this, pass it on, or link to it on the EcoShock.org website.
Fish are a great food source. The omega-3 acids in fish are good for the brain, which makes us smart. Yet, one of the ways we catch fish smashes their entire habitat, wiping out species we haven't even named, which makes us really stupid.
In one of the greatest environmental movies ever made, the desperate hordes of humans eat green factory-made squares called Soylent Green. These food cakes were supposedly made out of rich plankton protein from the seas. But then a researcher finds a report that ocean life has long since expired. Can't happen here. Listen to this report from Deutsche Welle Radio.
Deep sea fish species in the Northern Atlantic are on the brink of extinction. Canadian scientists studied five deep water species, including hake and eel, and they say that some populations have plummeted by 98% in a generation, meeting the definition of critically endangered. Scientists and conservation bodies are now pressing for a global moratorium on deep-sea fishing, which they regard as particularly destructive. Some fleets have switched to deep-sea fisheries following the collapse in the more commonly caught species such as cod. Known as bottom trawling, these ships often use heavy trawls which are dragged across the ocean floor, destroying coral and other ecosystems.
That was Jonathan Gifford from Deutsche Welle's flagship environment program called Living Planet. He's referring to news reports like The Independent from January 5th, 2006 that, quote, "The trend for deep sea trawling puts rare fish species on the ocean's critical list." Three researchers from Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, analyzed the falling catch during the last 17 years in the Northwest Atlantic. Those species living on or near the bottom of the sea have declined between 87 and 98% over the last two decades. Using scientific analysis, this catch data reflects a real decline of an astounding 99% in a single human generation. We haven't seen anything like it since the mass murder of the dodo bird and the buffalo. Following their report in the journal Nature, Dr. Dixon told Steve Connor of The Independent, quote, "The impact of modern fishing methods on these deep-sea species is disastrous, as they can be wiped out of entire areas within a single season. There is a real danger that the slow-growing deep-water species will take centuries to recover from current fishing, if they can at all. In European waters, we should close deep-sea fisheries as a matter of urgency. They can be wiped out within a single season. Deep-water species will take centuries to recover, if at all.
Deep-water species will take centuries to recover."
The Independent gives the example of the orange roughy, a food fish discovered by French trawlers off the west coast of Scotland in 1989. By 1991, the catch peaked at 3,600 tons. By 1994, they got only 180 tons. Now, it's fished out. Will that stock take centuries to recover? if at all? While the carbon-soaked atmosphere reaches the boiling point, human imagination fails to reach the murky truth about disappearing ocean life. Here's Anya Coopers from Deutsche Welle Radio interviewing James Leap, the new Director General of the World Wildlife Fund, better known as the WWF. She asks, beyond climate change, what are the big threats to the environment which are less reported and less known? Director Leap, a 16-year veteran in the organization, replies ocean life is being demolished by climate change, overfishing, pollution, and especially deep-sea trawling.
I mean, you're right to start with global warming as the benchmark. It certainly stands out as the transcendent threat to nature around the world and frankly, to human welfare around the world. I think of similar magnitude is the startling decline in the health of the oceans. And we have only in recent years begun to become aware of just how much damage we have done to ocean ecosystems and how dependent we are on the health of those systems. And so it was just, for example, a couple of years ago that scientists discovered through new research that we have wiped out 90% of the big fish in the oceans, the tunas, the sharks, the billfish, and so forth. We had no idea how much devastation we had already caused. And when you realize that more than a billion people around the world depend upon fish for protein, you realize that the health of the oceans are important, or should be important, to all of us. And I think that's a coming issue.
There is even evidence that the larger species, from whales to salmon, are starving for lack of lower forms of marine food in the oceans. For more on this, check out www.fisherycrisis.com. Research shows that in some parts of the sea, plankton has been damaged by holes in the protective ozone layer as well. Back in 1951, before the invention of massive trawlers with satellite fish spotters and very deep gear, humans gathered about 20 million tons of fish in a year. By 2001, we took 92 million tons, four times more, even as ocean life was stressed by rampant pollution from land and air, plus unstable temperatures, storms, and shifting currents due to climate change.
This is the sound of a thriving native forest. This is the sound of a weighted net tearing its way through the forest floor, killing everything in its path. This is happening every day to acres of thriving coral forests, teeming with life on the seafloor around the world. Visit greenpeace.org.nz to find out how you can help Greenpeace halt high seas bottom trawling before it wipes out deep sea life.
More than 20% of all coral reefs have been damaged beyond recovery. 67% are severely damaged. These are the nurseries for the sea's riches. 35 million acres of coral have been destroyed in just the last 30 years. While we sleep comfortably in our beds, 90% of the North Sea floor is scraped bare at least once a year. Some is clear-cut by dragging weights and nets several times a year. Most of the catch is thrown back dead.
Manta shrimp?
No.
Lizard fish?
No.
Giant squid?
No.
Black coral?
Don't be stupid.
Lantern shark?
No.
Weird fish I haven't seen before?
No.
Orange roughy?
Yep.
Bottom trawlers drag thousands of deep sea species to the surface, yet keep only a few fish. Please help Greenpeace halt high seas bottom trawling before it wipes out our deep sea life.
Not much is left. There is no TV footage, just wrecked ocean bottoms. Fish can't scream, don't protest, don't buy anything. They just disappear, unless humans can wake up and speak for them.
Fishing boats in search of shrimp, cod, rockfish, and other bottom-dwelling seafood delicacies drag heavy nets along the seafloor. Sea creatures not caught can be crushed, buried, or exposed to predators. These boats are bottom trawling, also known as dragging. Like forest clear-cutting or strip mining, destructive bottom trawling crushes habitat. It is critical to take action immediately to address this ocean environmental crisis. Every day, bottom trawling destroys irreplaceable seafloor habitat. The more we discover about deep-sea corals and sponges, the better we understand how extremely sensitive these ancient, slow-growing animals are to even minimal disturbance. The havoc wreaked by bottom trawl gear today may not heal in our lifetime, if ever. Furthermore, we are just beginning to understand that the decimation of corals and sponges has a ripple effect. When they disappear, so may many of the fish and other animals dependent on a strong and healthy ecosystem for food, shelter, and protection.
You can get a video of the shocking damage caused by ocean trawling from oceana.org. Stop destructive deep-sea trawling. Contact Greenpeace or Oceana or WWF to find out what you can do. To find out what fish is safe to eat and which are unsustainable or endangered, look at the Seafood Watch guide provided by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Go to mbayaq.org or just Google Seafood Watch, and the aquarium guide tops the list. Check out the safe seafood menu or look up your favorite dish. Avoid those red light species that are disappearing from Earth's roster of life. This report comes from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. We close out with a clip from the song Te Waka, Our Ocean, written for Greenpeace New Zealand.
I give you my voice, together we make a stand. We're making the right choice for our future and for our children too. Hear the cries of the ocean, cries of caution from our ancestors. We can't be defeated. United we can win.
Adi, adi, adi,
this is my ocean, this is my future, my choice. This ocean is my home. This is our ocean. This is our future. Our choice. The Pacific is my home. What do we say to our ancestors when all the fish are gone? If we fail to protect our home, all our future children to come, the hope lies in us. This is my ocean, this is my future, my choice. This ocean is my home. This is our ocean, this is our...
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
We have breaking news on the UN resolution. According to Josh Heilprin in the Associated Press, October 4th, President Bush called yesterday for a halt to destructive fishing techniques on the high seas. He also said the United States will work to eliminate or to better regulate such practices as bottom trawling that devastate fish populations and might severely disturb the ocean floor. Bush directed the State and Commerce Departments to promote, quote, sustainable fisheries and to oppose practices that destroy the long-term natural productivity of fish stocks or habitats such as seamounts, corals, and sponge fields for short-term gain. So this comes just as the United Nations is prepared to discuss deep-sea trawling today, Friday. That leaves just Russia, Norway, and Iceland opposed, and possibly Canada, because our fisheries minister is from Newfoundland and possibly has trawlers on his own mind. You're listening to Radio EcoShock, every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Here in BC, oceans are in trouble. Fish stocks collapsing, unsustainable practices. So in the studio today, we have Catherine Stewart, the campaign director for BC-based Living Oceans Society. Catherine, how do we figure out what fish to eat and what to avoid as threatened or unsustainable?
Well, actually, a coalition of five very respected Canadian environmental groups, including Living Oceans Society, just last week launched a new program called Sea Choice. And it's an analysis of both the fish that are sold in Canadian markets and retail outlets and restaurants, as well as fisheries that are undertaken in Canada. The program is based on the Monterey Bay Aquarium standards that look at the sustainability and health of the stocks, the method of fishing, the impact on the stocks, and whether or not they're in good shape or bad shape. And the difference is, it's made in Canada by Canadians and for Canadians. So part of that program has produced a small wallet card that you can carry with you that lists fish as green, which is go, they're fine, they're in good shape, yellow, which means you should be more cautious, only eat them occasionally, in some cases you need to look for up-to-date information on our website, and red, which are no-go, these stocks are in trouble, the fisheries are unsustainable, and you should avoid eating them.
So that's easy. I could be a card-carrying fish lover then.
You could indeed.
All right. Well, I noticed from your website that one company, Albion Fisheries or Neptune Foods, has supported this new Sea Choice program. But where do the big supermarket chains stand?
Well, at the moment, they're standing far away and far back. There's no labeling in most major Canadian supermarkets. There are no stickers to indicate whether a fish is coming from a stock that's healthy and sustainable. They don't even label whether salmon, in many cases, they don't label whether salmon is farmed or wild. And certainly farm salmon has a lot of problems associated with it. Now, there are some smaller retail chains and health food and specialty stores that are becoming more selective about the type of fish that they carry. And restaurants, a lot of restaurants have joined programs like the Aquarium's Oceanwise program that identifies some stocks as being sustainable and more favorable to ocean ecosystems and ocean health. But we have a long way to go. Generally, in the major retailers, the supermarket chains in Canada, there has been no change, and they're still selling everything and anything. And we're hoping that this program will help set them on a path to a more sustainable direction.
All righty. Well, the Sea Choice campaign has a few different aims. You want to work with industry, you say, and to push them towards sustainability, and with governments and First Nations people, the supermarkets, as we talked about, and the fish sellers. But where do we fit in, the people who just like to eat well from the sea?
Well, for starters, you can start by carrying the wallet cards and checking out our website. The coalition, Sustainable Seafood Canada, includes the Sierra Club, the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, the David Suzuki Foundation, on the East Coast, the Ecology Action Center, and of course, Living Ocean Society. The cards are available from any and all of those groups. Once you've got that card in your pocket, the main thing to do is ask. If you go out for dinner in a restaurant, ask about the fish on the menu. Ask your waitress, where are these prawns from? Are they farmed or are they wild? Were they caught locally or were they caught somewhere else? Ask about the fish and try and find out as much as you can. They may not know the answer. In many cases, they won't know the answer, but you'll have your wallet card with you. You can make the choice to say, even if you know that the fish is red listed, to ask where it's from, ask the waitress about it or waiter, and then tell them that you're not going to order it because you know it's unsustainable, and encourage them to carry sustainable seafood products. We also have available through the Sea Choice program little what we call drop cards, which are like a little business card size card that has Sea Choice logo on the front and says on the back a message like, we like your establishment, we really appreciate the food, we want to come back, but we encourage you to become a partner in Sea Choice and to start carrying more sustainable products. You can also talk to your government representatives, of course. I mean, a lot of the reasons why fisheries are unsustainable is because the regulations aren't strict enough, they're not well monitored, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans isn't doing a good enough job. Hold your elected officials accountable. Demand that they do a better job. One unsolicited letter from an individual who cares is worth more than 500 signatures on a petition. So if you care about these issues, then let the government know, and that will help us and help you.
Where can people get more information? What was that website?
Seachoice.org, not .com, .org, Seachoice.
All right. Well, in a couple of minutes, we'll be back with Catherine Stewart, this time to get the scoop on the demand for really safe practices from the aquaculture industry. As it is, farmed salmon are threatening our wild stocks, which are already in trouble. Let's listen to this piece first.
We've launched this campaign, Pure Salmon, to talk about the problems with salmon aquaculture.
Sea lice are a small crustacean, so they're the same group as crabs or shrimp, except they're parasitic, and they have a particular taste for salmon, and that's why we see so many around salmon farms. Well, they're a problem because they actually eat the salmon. They're what's known as an ectoparasite, or a parasite that sits on the outside of the fish, and when they land on the fish, they start from the outside and eat their way in. The fish that are, when they hit the ocean, are about the size of a AA battery. And the lice themselves are about the size of an eraser head on a pencil. So to put it into terms that are relative to a human, it would be the same as you having 50-pound lice chewing through your back. When you have significant aquaculture activity in open net pens, you also have a response in the wild salmon trout populations of rapid decline. And we've seen this in Europe, and now we seem to be repeating the European experience here. We look across the world where you have open net pen industrial salmon farming and wild salmon and trout populations, the story is the same again and again and again. The wild fish pay the price because you've got an abundance of fish. Again, you've got a million fish in a small net pen. As soon as one of them gets infected, all of them will become infected. And when all of them become infected, they produce a vast amount of these infective parasitic larvae, which have no choice but to infect the wild fish as they swim by. We've seen this again and again. The weight of the independent scientific world, or the weight of the evidence generated by independent scientists, is unanimous and speaks with a single voice that the farms are a major driving force in the decline of these wild populations.
The Pure Salmon Campaign's ultimate goal is to get producers to change the way they farm salmon currently. And if they do that, then the full promise of aquaculture will be realized, and we'll have more fish and good, healthy fish for people to eat.
Canada has its own Farmed and Dangerous campaign on aquaculture. Catherine Stewart, why should we care about it?
Well, the aquaculture industry, the open net cage industry in British Columbia, is having a very profound environmental impact. The waste from the farms is accumulating on the bottom and smothering the benthic or ocean bottom environment. It's being carried away from the farms in areas of high tidal flushing and landing on clam beaches, contaminating clams and making them inedible, which is a real serious concern for First Nations issues. There are escape fish colonizing our rivers in BC, and even though the industry has claims to have improved its practices in recent years and reduced the number of escapes, we still have colonizers out there. More than 80 BC rivers have been tracked to have Atlantic salmon in them that clearly have escaped from the fish farms. There are huge concerns with the Liberal government's agenda for expanding the industry throughout the coast of BC, but above all else is the threat to our wild salmon stocks, the threat from sea lice and disease, and in particular the sea lice attacking the juvenile fish. And we should care because wild salmon are the backbone of the coastal ecosystem in British Columbia. They're the foundation on which all other life is built. If you like bears, if you like orca whales, if you like eagles, if you care about ancient old-growth cedar trees, all of those depend on salmon for nutrients. 70% of the nitrogen in old-growth trees in riparian areas on the coast of BC, the nitrogen comes from wild salmon. It's dragged into the woods by the predators, and it fertilizes the growth of those forests. So everything rests on a foundation of healthy wild salmon stocks, and there are countless threats to those salmon stocks, but the aquaculture industry is one that we can do something about.
And that's because it's inshore, it's within our legislative powers or within the government powers to do something about it?
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds very benign to say salmon farmers. Farming we think of as like a family-run operation. But about 90% of the farm salmon that are produced on the BC coast are produced by foreign-owned corporations, giant multinationals, Nutreco from Holland, Panfish based in Norway, Cermaq based in Norway. you know, these are foreign owners who are exploiting the coast of British Columbia for their profit and gain. And the regulations that control these farms are very weak. And we're not doing anywhere near enough to address the impact that they're having on our wild stocks.
Who is working on this issue now?
Well, there's a number of groups working on it. In fact, Living Ocean Society is part of a 9-member coalition called the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform. We're often dubbed by the industry advocates as being anti-aquaculture, which is not the case. That's why we're called about aquaculture reform, because we want to see the industry make a transition into far more sustainable practices than are currently in use. We believe there is a place for aquaculture in today's society if it's done right. And right now in BC, it's being done very badly. So the coalition includes Living Ocean Society, the David Suzuki Foundation, the Georgia Strait Alliance. There's quite a number of groups, and also the Musquamaw-Zawadanik Tribal Council, a group of 4 First Nations based in the Broughton Archipelago, which is an area at the north coast of Vancouver Island that has one of the highest concentrations of fish farms in the province. These First Nations have been living with the impacts of these farms for years. The rockfish in their areas are contaminated with mercury that's originating from the farms. Their clam beds are poisoned with waste from the farms. They're feeling the impact more than anyone, and they're trying to work towards changes in the practices of open net cage aquaculture in BC.
Well, we've definitely got to do something about that. What is the website for CAR, this coalition of BC groups?
Farmedanddangerous.org, all one word, farmedanddangerous.org.
That's pretty easy to remember, I'd say. When we're at the fish counter, what should we be looking out for?
Well, in Canada, farm salmon aren't required to be labeled, and this is one of the things that CAR has been demanding for quite some time. Let the consumer know what the product is. Label it. If it says fresh Atlantic salmon, it's farmed. There are no Atlantic salmon commercial fisheries. The stocks are virtually wiped out. Atlantic salmon are in huge trouble. And if you're finding Atlantic salmon in a supermarket or a restaurant, you can bet your life it's farmed. Sometimes they farm Chinook salmon. So ask at the fish counter, is this wild or is it farmed? And if it's farmed, tell them that you're not going to buy it.
That seems like a good thing to do. People, the oceans are sick and stripped. We need your help to save what's left. Catherine Stewart, keep going, and thanks for coming on Co-op Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
The Vancouver Sun reports that nearly two-thirds of Canadians believe the federal government won't do much to stave off climate change. An Ipsos Reid poll found 63% are, quote, desperately concerned that the world may not last much longer than another couple of generations. Our provincial government doesn't seem to have a plan other than tax breaks to produce more fossil fuels and spending on still more highways for carbon mobiles. We have Shane Simpson on the line. He's the MLA for Vancouver Hastings and the environment critic for the New Democratic Party. Shane, does your party have a plan for climate change?
We do, and it's great to have a chance to talk to you. What we've done at this point is we've said the first thing that needs to happen right now is we need to begin to develop a meaningful plan. What we've suggested is that a legislative committee be struck, a special committee of the legislature be struck, and that it travel the province. It talk to people about the changes that need to be made, about how we begin to reduce emissions, and at the same time also begin a discussion around adaptation issues as to where we know that climate change is going to be upon us. What kinds of things do we need to do in terms of policies and programs to be able to deal with the impacts of climate change long term?
Well, so you're starting by getting the feeling around the province, but are you also putting out your own message with that?
Oh, we are. I mean, I think there's a whole range of things that we need to look at. We need to look at conservation. We need to look at a sustainable transportation strategy. We need to look at the role of BC Hydro and empowering BC Hydro to play a greater role in renewable energy, and how we access that renewable energy. We need to have the government play a greater role around urban sustainability and to support local governments in some of their smart growth efforts. And we probably need to look at the building code and begin to look at maybe putting into the building code requirements around green buildings so that all of the construction that we're doing in future, in fact, has a green tone to it.
Well, who exactly is going to be involved? I mean, are these all NDP MLAs, or who's going to be there?
Well, what we've called for is a special committee of the legislature, much like we're doing now with sustainable aquaculture. It would be a committee struck by the legislature. It would have it would be an all-party committee. It would be empowered by the legislature to go out to do whatever outreach it had to do, to be able to bring in whatever experts it needed. To bring in supports to develop a plan and develop a strategy, which would then be brought back to the legislature, provided to the legislature in the form of a report that would then be dealt with and hopefully adopted by government, by the legislature and then by government, and that would then form the basis, hopefully, of an effective plan. Part of the challenge we have now is we do have what the government calls an action plan on climate change, but it has no standards. It has about 47 or 48 actions in it, many of them that are quite minor, and most of them that there's been little progress made on.
Well, I've got to ask you, too. In the past, there's been some bad feelings between unions and environmentalists, especially on logging, but now this climate thing seems a lot bigger than all that. Do you see ways that we can get unions more involved in this critical issue?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is I think that that the labor movement is quite engaged in the issue of climate change, as is the environmental community, as is the business community. There's a whole lot of people in business, particularly the resource sector, who are very concerned about climate change. The forest industry is very engaged in the issue because they're seeing what's happened with the pine beetle. They fully understand where that came from and the impacts of climate on creating the crisis with the pine beetle. In the mining industry, they're concerned as well because water is such a critical piece of that industry. And if they don't see the water flows they're looking for, they have a problem. So I think we're seeing a real consensus being built. When we see people like Arnold Schwarzenegger in California becoming champions of climate change, it tells you that the business community, among others, are getting concerned, as are First Nations, as are environmentalists, as are local communities, as are just citizens generally.
So we need something to bring that together so we know we are working together.
Well, we do. And we need to, you know, the best case argument right now is we probably have, 15, maybe 20 years at the outside to develop substantive, meaningful plans and have them in place and operating if we're going to deal with and mitigate the impacts of climate change.
Well,
that's an awful lot of work, but we need to start doing it right now, and that means putting a meaningful and substantive plan in place, and British Columbia doesn't have such a plan.
I agree. Well, when would you know if the legislature will do this?
Well, of course, we won't know because the government has canceled this sitting of the legislature. So we won't be able to actually bring this matter before them. So what I will be doing is we're calling on to get a commitment from the government and from Gordon Campbell that he would put this in place in the February sitting. I don't anticipate getting that commitment. And if that doesn't occur, then we're going to need to make decisions as the opposition about how we support engaging that conversation over the coming months. But this is something that we're not planning to sit back and let just sit. We are going to push forward on this, and we are going to attempt to get action on this and to increase the profile of this question from a provincial perspective.
Well, I think we're all in the same boat in the sense that the leadership at the top isn't acting anywhere near quickly enough, and that's what this Ipsos Reid poll shows as well, that people are worried about it. And as the official opposition, you've got some government resources. Do you think that the NDP itself can bypass Campbell's machine if it doesn't act and get some real traction on this issue?
Well, we hope so, and we hope that that others will partner with us, whether it's the environmental community, whether it's stakeholder groups, whether it's local governments. We're hoping that that we can engage other critical pieces of sectors of the community in a way that will get some traction and will put additional pressure on the government to come forward with meaningful plans. We have a situation now where we know that British Columbia, based on a 2004 report of Environment Canada, we've had the second highest increase in our emissions of any province in the country. The response to that, of course, is the government approves coal-fired plants for part of their energy purchase through BC Hydro.
Unbelievable.
And that's their response, is to approve old-style coal plants that clearly are going to add tons and tons of greenhouse gases to our emissions.
Well, we want to be the greenhouse gas supplier for the world, really, whether it's selling new gas and oil to the Americans or shipping coal over to Asia. At some point, doesn't British Columbia really have to look at its own role in climate change?
Well, I think we do. And I think we need to make determinations about how we're going to approach some of these issues, including we know that that there's a real discussion around whether there is such a thing as clean coal. And I think it's a fair discussion to have. Experts that I talk to tell me that the technology to do real clean coal with zero emissions is there in theory. It's got a ways to go before you could ever put it in place in a commercially viable way. But we ought to talk about that. We know that coal is going to drive a lot of the energy in the world. We know in China and India, they're planning to build 700 new plants over the next 20 or 30 years, coal-fired plants. If we can help to find that new technology that is legitimately clean technology with zero emissions, we should look at doing that.
Well, it may be possible. They have the sequestration where they bury it in the ground
exactly.
Already going in a pilot plant in Saskatchewan, I believe it is.
They have it going there. Also, the Americans are doing work on it. I believe the American government has invested a couple of $100 million. In modeling exactly that technology in the United States.
Maybe we could provide some energy without the guilt.
Well, you know, it would be a good thing to do if it's doable. But what we need to do is determine whether it's actually doable and can accomplish the objectives around zero emissions. If it is, then we should look at it.
Well, if our listeners want to find out more about NDP activities on climate change, where should they go?
Well, they could contact me. I'd be happy to hear from them. And they could send me an email, and we would respond or send material. And I can be reached at shane.simpson@ledge.bc.ca. And any emails, I'd be happy to connect people up or send back information. I'd also love to get any ideas or comments people have about how we approach these issues, because they're big and they're complicated issues, and we need to deal with them at a whole range of levels. And we're looking for help, and we're looking to try to provide leadership here. But we're all in this together, so it'd be great to work with others.
Well, Shane Simpson, thanks for taking the time to talk with Radio EcoShock today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Get happy this October with sounds you won't hear anywhere else. Just extra special radio for the Fall Member Drive. Slavery to Emancipation. Latin, jazz, Celtic rock. The Happy Hour. Keep it on the air. Sign up starting October 12th. Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM, Vancouver. Join us.
We've got Josh Brandon on the line from Greenpeace right here in Vancouver. Josh, what's your campaign doing?
Well, I'm on the genetically modified organisms campaign here in Vancouver, and there's a lot of exciting events coming up. One thing that your listeners might want to pay attention to is the Food Secure Canada conference that's coming up. It's centered at the Wall Center, but there's events all around the city There's going to be events, workshops, themes around food security. One of the highlights of that, we're bringing in one of our researchers from Montreal, Dr. Eric Derrier, and he's going to be speaking on the regulation of GE foods here in Canada. And so there's going to be a lot of interesting discussion around that.
We have regulation in Canada?
Well, unfortunately, at Greenpeace, we found that Canada's moving further and further away from the global consensus that we really need scientific-based caution to moderate these technological developments. And so we're seeing more and more loose regulation, unfortunately. Now, just to clarify for the listeners who might not know much about the issue, genetic engineering refers to a specific process of altering the biology of organisms. Now, as you know, farmers have been changing biology of plants and animals for thousands of years through traditional techniques like selective breeding. But for the last 30 years, there's been new technologies and new techniques developed to alter the biology of organisms right at the genetic level by direct transfer or removal of genes within an organism. And we see that there's specific dangers associated with that.
So this is where we can see fish genes in tomatoes and things like that.
Exactly. Unfortunately, here in Canada, we've found that, since the 1990s, governments in Canada and the United States have both accepted the arguments of agribusiness and the chemical industries that genetically modified organisms don't constitute any specific threat and don't need any specific regulations beyond those used to regulate foods more generally.
So are we protected now?
Unfortunately, we're not protected very much at all. Governments have been letting in more and more genetically modified foods into our food system. There's a recent scandal that's emerging around the world around genetically engineered rice. There's a strain that Greenpeace researchers discovered working in concert with Friends of the Earth in Europe. We found GE rice contaminating the food supply and ending up in grocery stores there. Now, we don't know whether that's gotten into the food supply here, because the government here isn't doing much testing around that, very little regulation. Other countries around the world are responding with very serious actions. Japan, they're testing all rice from the U.S. Other countries have responded with moratoriums on imports from the U.S. But here in Canada, the response of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the agency that's responsible for protecting Canadian food supply, has responded with the assurance that the rice is not at any danger in the absence of any scientific evidence on this issue. In fact, they've even said that the reason that they're responding in this way is that it's very similar to other forms of genetically modified rice. And to us at Greenpeace, that doesn't constitute a reason to expose Canadians to this sort of danger.
And is this the Bayer brand you're talking about?
Exactly. The company that's producing the rice is Bayer. They're an international chemical and pharmaceutical corporation. They've produced a strain of rice that's resistant to one of the herbicides that they've developed called Liberty. And there's all kinds of dangers around this, because there's dangers that it's going to that the genes that they've developed are going to transfer into the weeds, and so we're going to develop new strains of super weeds that are herbicide resistant. It's going to increase the usage of pesticides and potentially dangerous to the health of consumers as well.
Well, when is the Food Secure Conference coming up?
Well, there's a number of events throughout the week. October 7th, it all kicks off. The event I was talking about with Eric Derrier is going to be on Tuesday morning. at the Wall Center. But for all the events, the best place to go is the Food Secure Canada website, foodsecurecanada.org. And for more information about Greenpeace's involvement with genetically modified food campaigns, check out both the national site, greenpeace.ca, or the international site, greenpeace.org. Both have excellent resource materials.
Well, Josh Brandon of Greenpeace, thanks a lot for talking with us today. Obviously, we've got to talk again and dig a lot deeper into these issues.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. That's it. Another jam-packed program from Radio EcoShock. If you have something you'd like to contribute, get a hold of us at radio@ecoshock.org. Tune in for our special program next week. We've got Elizabeth May, the new leader of the Green Party, in a speech recorded here in Vancouver just this summer, talking about the tar sands. And while we're at it, I think we'll have to give the tar sands a good whipping for all that greenhouse gas coming from Canada. You don't want to miss that. Next Friday and every Friday at 1 o'clock. We're going out with a song by Shane Phillip of Vancouver Island from his album Earthshake. It's called Def Mix.
Sometimes it's good, good, good. And sometimes I got to do what I should. I can see it, and I don't believe it. Over and over, over and over.